Andrew Cohen joins me this morning, the journalist, professor, and best-selling author of Adil Andun, the book on the Meech Lake Accord, and While Canada Slept, as well as Trudeau's Shadow, which he co-edited with J.L. Granstein, has a new book. It's called The Unfinished Canadian, The People We Are, published by McClelland & Stewart. It retails for $29.99. It is a well-written and highly readable book that looks at who we are as Canadians and where we belong. It's ground well covered in the past, but Cohen's take is original and thought-provoking, often witty, making for an enjoyable and informative read. A finalist for a 2006 National Newspaper Award, Andrew Cohen is an associate professor at Carleton and is a syndicated columnist at the Ottawa Citizen. He joins me from Ottawa this morning. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Andrew Cohen. Good morning, Mr. Cohen.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Why do you think it is that we as Canadians ignore our history and at the same time are rather rude to people in it? And I think of former prime ministers, for example, where in the United States or in Britain they're held in esteem by the people as well as the current inhabitants of office themselves.
Well, let me answer your first question first on history. We have a history. We just choose not to study it. This has been the conclusion of many people before I came around. The historian whom you just mentioned, J.L. Granstein, wrote a book about 10 years ago called Who Killed Canadian History? And he's updating it, I think, for publication next year. And he says to me that he actually finds the situation even worse now in terms of the ignorance of our past than it was 10 years ago. How does this manifest itself? Well, we have survey after survey showing us that half of Canadians don't know who Sir Johnny MacDonald was, and don't know what D-Day was, and don't know what we did in World War II or I, or think that all we ever did was peacekeeping, which we have done, but it's not the primary role. We have the Auditor General reporting that two-thirds of our historic sites are in danger of crumbling, as she did 4 years ago. We have a Canadian Museum of Civilization in Ottawa, which is so politically correct, it does not talk about whole elements of our history, such as the Siege of Quebec in 1759, or the October Crisis in 1970, or the referendums in Quebec in 1980 and 1995. We have a shortage of biography. Our historians don't turn out biography the way they do in the United States about our figures from the past. We just don't see the volume. We haven't had a big biography of Sir Johnny MacDonald since the 1950s, or one on Mackenzie King probably since the 1970s. So in many ways, we are unconscious. I call it the unconscious Canadian, Joe, because we are detached. One of the reasons 6 of 10 provinces essentially do not teach Canadian history, they may teach a form of it or social studies. So for those who want to know our past, new Canadians who come here, we don't ask them to know very much when they become citizens. We don't seem to care very much. Now, why is that? Probably because we don't have a lot of self-confidence, or we're insecure. We are influenced by other societies and think their history is more important than ours. I would venture that probably more Canadians know who Abraham Lincoln is than know who Sir Johnny MacDonald is or was. And I think that it's just we don't consider it important. The other question which you raised is more, I think, in the realm of civility and how we treat each other. You mentioned how our prime ministers, and they are figures in our history, treat each other. And I examine that, and I think it's an interesting observation that essentially the office of the prime minister does not confer the same respect upon its former occupant as does the presidency of the United States. So if you look at how John Diefenbaker and Lester Pearson viewed each other, or Brian Mulroney and most of his successors, or Jean Chrétien and Paul Martin, there really is a disdain, if not a real antipathy, for each other. And this is different from, the presidency, in which in the United States, the presidency, those who have that office, George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton, for example, they treat each other very well. They raise money for the tsunami or AIDS in Africa. And so it's a much different ethic of how people go about that. And I think it's something we can learn from the United States.
I guess I raised the former prime ministers because in some way whoever holds that office at whatever time in history reflects who we are. Do you think that that reflects Canadians and how we view ourselves or how we treat each other?
Sorry, the people who are Prime Minister?
You know, the people ourselves, like you and I, how they treat each other, does that reflect on how we treat ourselves and how we treat each other?
How Prime Ministers treat each other.
Yeah.
My larger argument, Joe, is that, as this book looks at many elements of our national character, we just talked about the unconscious Canadian, that the Canadian doesn't know his or her past. Yes, I think it does. We like to think of ourselves as a very civil people and with a very civil politics. Well, in many ways, it isn't so civil. You may recall the attack ad the Conservative Party ran against Stephen Dion in January and February of this year, last winter. We're very much in the American style, and we're always talking about American style politics as if it is much cruder and much less virtuous than ours. I think, yes, the manner in which our Prime Ministers treat us do reflect us, because we, in a sense, degrade public service in Canada. We're very hard on politicians. We don't trust them. We're reluctant to give them raises. Public servants, we make them post their expense accounts on the Internet. Politicians, we're always looking if they spend $1 too much, if they take a flight too far, if they have a lunch too many. The official residences, I look at how we treat leaders and where they live, and our official residences, you know, for years, 24 Sussex Drive, has been too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter because they simply won't make the kind of renovations necessary to bring that up to a certain standard. John Kretzing used to boast to people that the curtains that hung in 24 Sussex Drive were made from the tablecloths used at the G8 conference in Halifax in the 1980s. I mean, that seems to be not something that we ought to be very proud of. And I think it reflects the whole question of official residence. It's not just that residence, the residence of official leaders, official opposition as well, called Stornoway, which is in Ottawa as well. I don't think that it reflects a very great confidence or dignity in which we treat politicians. And I think it does reflect a certain strain of our character.
You mentioned that we degrade those in public service. I guess this builds into an aspect that you cover in the book about how we seem to resent success, the success of others, as well as heroes, legitimate or otherwise, that we seem to have a lack of in this country.
Yes, well, I do examine success, and it begins, in fact, the genesis of this book was the Olympics of 2006, at which women's hockey team competed, and you may recall that our women's hockey team did extraordinarily well. They won one game 16-0, another game 12-0, 8-0, I think, and then virtually a squeaker was won by 6-1. And at home, you would have thought this would have brought a great chorus of congratulations. Instead, it brought in some quarters hissing and hand-wringing and skepticism. And I say this because Don Cherry, who was kind of Shakespearean in Canada and a commentator, said that it was un-Canadian for the Canadian women's hockey team to win this way. They were, quote, running up the score. Father Jay D'Souza of the National Post said pretty much the same thing, and letter writers agreed. And it was an extraordinary thing that we would be pillaring our women's hockey team for doing too well. It was as if the only thing worse than losing in Canada was winning. And that struck me as odd. It's something of the Canadian character about success. And if you look at it, though, we do have this strange thing. It's called the tall poppy syndrome. It isn't from here. It really comes from New Zealand or Australia. And what it means is that if you rise too high in Canada, you're in danger of being cut down. It's the famous story of Lester Pearson winning the Nobel Prize in 1957 for peace for his work in the Sinai. And when word got back to Canada, it was said there was a cocktail party in Vancouver, and a woman heard the news, announced it to everybody, and said, "Mike Pearson has just won the Nobel Peace Prize." Well, who does he think he is? And that is not an uncommon Canadian reaction. And I go through how we view success, that we are, in a sense, a nation of accounts of envy, and because much of my book is reflected in how, in our political institutions, I look at how provinces and governments treat each other. And you may have noticed that, you know, provinces are always complaining the latest is Danny Williams, but Quebec and other provinces have done it for years. And that's behind the whole fiscal imbalance, which I would say in a country of a trillion-dollar economy is something of a mental imbalance, because, in fact, we are a very rich country, and we ought not to be arguing about this. So there are many examples of the tall poppy syndrome. The manner in which we treated the vice-regal couple, John Ralston Saul and Adrian Clark, since she was Governor General from 1999 to 2005, was in many ways unrelenting criticism for a couple which tried very, very hard to renew an antiquated institution and bring it to Canadians across the country. So I think it is a strain in our character. And we see this, Joe, in heroes. You mentioned heroes. We're not a country which is quick to acknowledge heroism. We have a Hall of Honor in Parliament, in the center block, which was supposed to be a forum to celebrate our heroes. There is actually nobody in that. No names are there at all. There are collective references made to nurses, I think, and soldiers, but there are not individual names in the Hall of Honor. At the Organization of American States in Washington, there is all the countries who are members, and we are one, are supposed to honor a national hero. We have an empty pedestal in front of Canada in that great Hall of Honor because we have none. We're not great in we have heroes, but we're not great at celebrating them. Peter Newman, the author and columnist, says that we would prefer in Canada to be Clark Kent more than Superman, and I think there's a lot of truth to that. When it comes to honoring people, we have an honor system. We're marking its 40th anniversary this year. It's the Order of Canada. We honor about 125 Canadians every year with the Order of Canada, a member honor, member companion, officer, three different levels. And there are now about 3,000 living members of the Order of Canada. But by contrast, and how other countries honor, France has the Légion d'honneur. And France is about twice the size of Canada, a little bit more than that. And it has some 120,000 living members of the Légion d'honneur. So heroes, thanking, celebrating success, it isn't one of our strong suits.
But Andrew, some people will say, well, perhaps that's a trait that Canadians are modest. Do you buy that?
We're modest to a degree, although I think that's probably changing now, modesty. My friends who go to the Caribbean tell me that Canadians are far more boisterous now about announcing where they're from and very American now in their nationalism. If you watch the Canada Day ceremonies every July 1st, you'll see lots of people erupting about Canada being the greatest country in the world. Certainly Prime Minister Chrétien did every year when the United Nations rated the world's greatest countries in terms of places to live, and we were up there for several years in a row. He took great pleasure in that, not that we shouldn't. We're now, by the way, down that list. We're not where we used to be. We're modest, but not always. And modesty doesn't always serve you well. If modesty is a failure to recognize those people who are working every day to make this a better country, I think they need our thanks, our gratitude, the applause of our nation, and they need our support. And I'm not so sure they get that from Canadians.
Well, it would be, when you were talking about resenting success and so on, I found some similarities in the book about how Canadians view our neighbors to the south, the United States, that there seems to be some sort of glib reaction to the United States. Did you find that there's a strain of anti-Americanism that's quite prominent in this country?
Yes. I call it the American-Canadian, and as I would have called the Canadians we talked about before, the chameleon Canadian, the Canadian that changes into many other things. The American Canadian isn't sure what to make of our relationship with the United States. Here we are sitting next door to the world's most powerful country, our neighbor for over 200 years, the only neighbor we have, and unable to really figure out our relationship with it, knowing that the United States buys much of what we make and supports financially much of what we do, yet being uncertain, critical, and often self-righteous in terms of the United States, and quick to criticize the United States, quick to be suspicious. There is, historians have identified what they call a hardy strain of anti-Americanism in the Canadian character. I'm not so sure it's anti-Americanism as much as an Ameriskepticism that bubbles up all the time. The former Secretary of State of the United States, Dean Acheson, who knew Canada quite well, and he served under Truman in the 40s. And
his mother was from Canada, wasn't she?
Yes, that's right, and he knew the country quite well. Called Canada stern daughter of the voice of God, always weighing in with kind of critical comments about the United States, which had international responsibilities Canada did not have. There is that element in Canada. It is illustrated in our politics. It bubbles up every little while. The best example, or the most recent example, was in the 2006 election campaign. That was the one in which Paul Martin lost to Stephen Harper. And in December of that campaign, the election was in January, but in December of that campaign, Mr. Martin goes to Montreal and goes to an international conference in Kyoto where he meets with Bill Clinton, and then he says, the United States, it doesn't have a conscience on the Kyoto Accord. I mean, of course, the United States had opposed the Kyoto Accord under the Bush administration. Well, as it turned out, the figures show that the American record on the environment and reducing emissions did much better than Canada. And but why did Mr. Martin say that? He knew that it slagging the United States does well in Canada. There is a reflexive reaction, and the next day the Liberal Party support went up in the polls. And the American ambassador came out a couple of days later and says, you don't have to raise Canada up by bringing the United States down. Well, in fact, the American ambassador meant well, but he's actually wrong. We do have to tear down the United States occasionally because it does make us feel better. It may be illusory, and there may be more Canadians or the more people in California who think like Canadians than actually are Canadians, but we cling to the idea of the United States being a certain way. We labor under all kinds of misperceptions about the United States. We say it's a melting pot and we're a mosaic, when in fact, if you look at the United States today, it's not a melting pot. It's actually quite a segmented society with a very strong Hispanic community, which is emerging as a power, not unlike French Canada in many states in the United States. We always consider ourselves to be savers, and they were spenders. Once again, we were more virtuous. Well, if you look at the savings rates today, they're not that too far apart. We are spending because we're making a lot of money. If you look at statistics on, we used to think we were skinny and they were fat. In other words, they were the obese Americans. If you look at our rates of obesity, they're very close to theirs now. So we feel, because we have to create differences in the United States, we're very concerned in Canada, and we define ourselves by what we're not. And we like to get up and say we're not Americans, which is fine, because we're not Americans. But it's what Freud called the narcissism of small differences, because in many respects, if you look at it, you'll find that there are probably no two peoples more alike in the world than Americans and Canadians.
And you also talk in the book about how we think we're more generous than Americans, when in fact we're not.
In charitable giving, yes, this is true. Now, there may be reasons. We give about a third. The average is about a third of what Americans give. Now, you could say, quite justifiably, well, their tax system rewards charitable giving, which is true to a degree. And also, we have social services here that are provided by the government, principally universal health care. But, the idea that Canadians are generous, I mean, in terms of foreign aid, which is one measure, in my last book called While Canada Slept, investigated foreign aid and our generosity, we slipped. I mean, we are now no longer one of the world's 10 leading donors, despite having the world's 8th largest economy, which is now a $1 trillion economy, a figure unimaginable when I was a child that we would ever be that wealthy. We are in the bottom rungs of nations who give money to an international assistance, once called foreign aid. We've just noticed, our charitable giving isn't what it ought to be, and our elite, frankly, which is quite wealthy, and while there are many fine examples of philanthropy, I'll give you one of, but just about a year ago, Ken Thompson died, you may remember, in June of last year.
Right.
And he, when he died, was considered the world's wealthiest, one of the world's wealthiest men, ninth richest, had a fortune of estimated between $19 and $23 billion, and essentially spent a life where he gave money to nobody. I mean, he did give his art collection to the art gallery of Ontario, And then when people came to him and said, that's very generous of you, he said, don't call me a philanthropist. People might get the wrong idea. So he never understood the wages of wealth. We learned what they could be in another country when 2 weeks later, Warren Buffett, who's the second richest man in the United States, announced that he was going to give away 85% of his wealth before he died. Well, in Canada, I just don't think we're as generous as we ought to be, both in terms of our government and personally. While there are examples of great generosity, and we see more and more of those, thank goodness, in all parts of the country, they're not enough, considering the wealth flowing out of this country.
One of the interesting things that we've seen in the people that have emerged in public life in the last couple of years, I think of Michael Jean, the Governor General, and Stéphane Dion, the Liberal leader, is questions about their loyalty to Canada, perhaps because they were dual citizens of this country and another country. You write in the book about citizenship, this idea of citizenship, whether we value it and whether Canadians feel that perhaps there's a place of premium on it, and in your experience is that we don't.
Yeah, I think citizenship, along with our relationship to the United States and the ignorance of our country, is a very important part of our character. I'm called the casual Canadian. Richard Gwynne, the author and columnist, says there's no citizenship in the world easier to obtain than Canada, and probably harder to lose. We're not very strict about offering our citizenship. People don't have to stay here very long. Many of them over certain ages or under certain ages don't have to write a test. If they do write a test, it's not terribly challenging on the history of Canada. Their knowledge of French or English, my sense is not what it should be. And so we're very cavalier about our citizenship. We don't think that it, I guess, should be harder to obtain than it is, although we have looked at the strength of the Citizenship Act on more than one occasion in recent years. Dual citizenship is one element of it, and three times in the last couple of years it's come up as an issue. Lebanon is the most recent. Last summer, you'll recall, there were 15,000 Canadians trapped in Lebanon. The government mounted an extraordinary effort to bring them out. It cost Canadian taxpayers $96 million. No questions were asked. We just thought, this is what you do. Your citizens are in trouble. The question we didn't ask, of course, was, who are these people and what is their allegiance to Canada? Had they ever been to Canada? Did they pay taxes to Canada? Did they have any attachment to Canada? Well, we got a sense of that, 6 weeks later when half of them went back to Lebanon, suggesting they had no ties at all to Canada. And it raised questions about dual citizenship. Now, it doesn't mean dual citizenship in and of itself is a bad thing, but I think you have to ask, and I think we should have the discussion about what it means to Canada. Two examples which you raised are Stéphane Dion and Michael Jean. Stéphane Dion became leader of the Liberal Party last December, and when asked would he renounce his dual citizenship, French citizenship, he said, well, I don't think so, but if it becomes an issue, I will. I'm not questioning personally Stéphane Dion's loyalty to Canada. I think he's a loyal Canadian. I just think that people, there ought to be absolute clarity when people hold offices that high. And the better example is Michel Jean, who acquired French citizenship just months before Paul Martin appointed her as Governor General in August of 2005, succeeding Adrian Marksman. While her credentials were questioned for that job because of her alleged comments or support for independence of Quebec, nobody said anything about her dual citizenship. And after all, the Governor General is Commander-in-Chief. Constitutionally, there are real responsibilities there. And Michel Jean was very kind and talked to me about this whole issue. And she said she came to the conclusion, although the Prime Minister had not told her this when he appointed her, in fact had said otherwise, had come to the conclusion that she ought to renounce her citizenship. She took some time to do it. Her appointment was announced at the beginning of August. Her installation in Parliament was the end of September, and she waited till 2 days before her installation to say, I'm renouncing. And she said the reason was that the government of France had to strike a special commission to look into this, and when they approved, she could renounce her citizenship. I question that, and I do know that emissaries were sent to her by Paul Martin, who had by then changed his mind on the whole citizenship question and said he wants to renounce. I don't think she was quite sure she should. She did, and the question put to her was, you know, what if you had to send a frigate to the island of Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, which lies off Newfoundland and is a French territory? What if you had to, do that? That would be a conflict of interest. So she renounced. But my point is, Joe, that we should be thinking more seriously of dual citizenship. We should be thinking more of the rights and responsibilities of citizenship and what it asks of Canadians. And I look at the whole question of multiculturalism and what that means and how that is intertwined with citizenship as well.
There's a phrase in the book, a word that you use in the book called agoraphobic, and I guess the meaning of that is the fear of a national commons, which Canadians seem to have. You also talk about where you live in Ottawa, and you criticize it for being unappealing architecturally. Do you think that the nation's capital reflects Canadians, reflects the country?
Well, let me just answer your first question first, if I may, on agoraphobia, that you're relating to my argument that, to borrow Jan Martel's phrase, Jan Martel, the novelist phrase, live in Hotel Canada. What I mean by that is we are very attached to multiculturalism. It seems to define us, and I worry that in our attachment or our deference to multiculturalism, we in fact are perhaps diminishing our Canadianism and are failing to define a clear Canadianism and a Canadian identity and a Canadian citizenship, which is based in a civic nationalism rather than an ethnic nationalism. So what I mean by that is if we all come to Canada and we live in our separate rooms, Indo-Canadians live among themselves, and Chinese Canadians live among themselves, and Aboriginal Canadians live on reserve. And, we are a segmented country, and while we get along with each other, and there's no doubt that we do, by and large, how much do we have to do with each other, and how much do we embrace a common sense of the country? And it is my fear that if we retreat to our rooms every night, having left them briefly during the day, that in fact we will not be creating a strong sense of the country and what it means to be Canadian. And this, by the way, is reflected also in our failure to teach our history. You mentioned the national capital, and I have a chapter called The Capital Canadian, in which I lament not the glories of what I call the parliamentary precinct, which would mean the parliament building, the Supreme Court, the office of the Prime Minister, the Chateau Laurier, and all those great buildings which are on, for those who visited Ottawa, our ceremonial mile, which is Wellington Street and then Sussex Drive, where the Prime Minister lives, the Governor General lives, and where the government departments and our embassies are there. What I lament is third-rate architecture and the erosion of the aesthetic one block or two blocks away from Parliament Hill. Ottawa itself has become an eyesore in many ways. Its major streets outside the parliamentary precinct have become unsightly, and this deterioration has gone on for some time. This got me into lots of trouble here in Ottawa, where I live. The Ottawa Citizen ran my chapter called The Capital Canadian, and it drew some reaction. Lots of support, but criticism as well. I say that Ottawa has not had a big idea in years, and my larger argument for those Canadians who obviously don't live in Ottawa, why should they care what their national capital looks like? I actually make the argument that beyond those people who live here, it is so important that we have a national capital we can be proud of and that has great national institutions, and that Canadians, and particularly Canadian school children, want to visit here. When I lived in Washington, which I did for 4 years as the correspondent of the Globe and Mail, I saw school kids come by the busload to Washington from Omaha and from Jackson, Mississippi, and from Portland, Maine, having saved and scrimped to pay for their school trips because they thought it was important that they'd see the White House, the capital of the Smithsonian Institution. We have things that people should see in Ottawa as well, but we have been not as aggressive as we might in building the kind of capital that would reflect the kind of country we are. And the kind of country we are is a very wealthy, important country. So we are fooling around with the idea of a national portrait gallery, and we think, well, we may send that to Calgary, and this is true. It's under debate now. We don't have a National History Museum. We don't have a National Science Museum. We have built embassies helter-skelter We have made strange decisions on putting strange buildings on our ceremonial mile. So there is lots we can do to make the national capital worthy. My question is, why do we think the way we do about our national capital? Years ago, Vincent Massey, who would become a governor general in 1952, the first native-born Canadian governor general, said, having lived in Washington, which he did, he said, what is it about Canadians? They are so grudging toward their national capital. They don't have the same pride as a Brit has in London, as a Frenchman has in Paris, or an American has in Washington. And I think we ought to change that.
Obviously, this book has hit a chord with Canadians. It's a bestseller already. You talked about the reaction that you've gotten from readers of the Ottawa Citizen. How do you think... How do you react to the reaction to your book? Do you think that we will become more conscious? Do you think that how history is taught in our schools, etc., will be improved?
Well, you know, a writer writes, and a writer does his or her best to put some ideas out there, and then to talk about them, and hope that other people want to talk about them. So, in Ottawa, this led to a debate of about 2 weeks in the pages of The Citizen on local radio and television stations about the nature of our city here, both that the city we live in as Ottawans and the city we live in as what I call capital Canadians. That, for a writer, is about as good as it can get. You try and do that. Other questions on the United States, on our history, on the elements of our character like resentment and envy, and those aren't just the only ones. I talk about our moderation, our ambiguity, our politeness, and how we interpret that. And I look at then the future Canadian and what we might be, and I recommend a number of things we may do, such as adopting what I call a civic liturgy, in which we strengthen our citizenship and we teach our history and we build a better capital. And I look at those challenges before us, and it's time to build again in Canada, an agenda, an ambition, and what we need to do to take this country successfully into the 21st century, which I think it will proudly venture into, already has. The reaction, so, is a wonderful thing, because it suggests to Canadians that they want to talk about these things. I've been invited to speak in places. The ultimate honor, of course, is that people buy your book and read your book, and Canadians are doing that, and I'm gratified for that. And I'm hoping we will have a discussion. I have to tell you that in some ways it's not easy. It is politically incorrect to say some things about our country. It is politically incorrect to challenge some notions, some home truths, some hot buttons. But I am pleased that the Canadians seem to want to have the conversation. I'll be touring the country for the next 6 weeks, speaking in Vancouver and Victoria, Saskatoon, and Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, and other cities, and even outside Canada, Washington, D.C., and hoping to do what I can in my little way to raise these questions, to foster a debate, to generate a discussion, to provoke some thought. That's as good as a writer can do or can be, and if Canadians respond, then I'm grateful and I'm honored.
Well, what are you working on now, Andrew?
I am just been commissioned to write a biography of Lester Pearson, who was, I think, a great prime minister. And it is part of what we call the Penguin Canadian Lives. You may know that Penguin, the publisher, has for years commissioned writers who write short, pithy biographies of international figures. And we're doing this now in Canada, so I will be working on that in the next little while.
Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today. We covered a lot of ground, and I'm sure there was more that we could talk about. Congratulations on a very fine book, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Joe.